Hi, it's Helen Hebert with Paper Talk. It's February 6th, 2017, and I'm in Oakland, California with Michelle Wilson at Rocinante Press. Mm-hmm. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Helen.
So how did you get involved in paper?
Well, I trained as a printmaker, mm-hmm. and honestly, part of it grew out of just more of a natural progression, but I really think because I feel sort of like a second or third generation American papermaker here, that I think part of it was just seeing work by amazing papermakers that made me want to try it.
And so where did you see that work?
I think mostly on the internet. Uh-huh. But I was like, I got to learn this stuff. These people are making really amazing stuff that I'm responding to. Mm-hmm. And so this was after undergrad, and I ended up enrolling at the University of the Arts because I was also interested in books and print, and they had everything there. And
right.
I learned it predominantly from Winnie Rattalin there, uh-huh, uh-huh. and I took a couple workshops with Amanda Degener, uh-huh. and Lynn Suarez was also there. So,
right.
And then just kind of got hooked, as it happens.
Right. It does happen. Yeah, I think the first time I saw your work was in that town. Mm-hmm. Where was that show?
Oh,
I got to go there. And so my mother tree was there, mm-hmm. and you had work.
And Sun Young and I were in the same class at UArts.
Okay. So what year did you graduate there?
2007.
Okay.
A 10-year anniversary.
All right, yeah. And so then, what did you do after UArts?
I pretty quickly started teaching. I had taught middle school before UArts, so I had been teaching. So I pretty much went back into teaching, mm-hmm. though incorporating, of course, what I'd learned. And I was trying to make my work. I didn't have a lot of facilities then. It was, mm-hmm. you know, your UArts was really, I don't know if I should say this on the podcast, a lot of alumni sneak back in to use uh-huh. facilities in uh-huh. Philadelphia. I don't know if that's still the case. Uh-huh. I don't know if that's actually allowed, but a lot of us did.
Yeah.
But I think that's actually, on one level, kind of a bonus of UArts because the alumni network ends up so tight.
Right.
And then and because the alum are there working, you kind of get to know people outside of your year. And
right, and it's so, it's hard to set up a papermaking facility.
Yeah, especially at the time, the paper studio was in the basement, so it was a lot easier to sneak in there. Uh-huh. they now have a beautiful paper studio.
Yeah, I've been. Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet, but
yeah. Right. And so that was Philadelphia. Now you're in California. How did you?
I came out here with my partner. Got a job. He's a curator, and he got a job as the curator of the DeRosa Museum, which is up in Napa.
Okay.
And we came here for that. Uh-huh. uh-huh. Been here ever since, basically. The short story of that.
Right. And so you're still teaching mm-hmm. and making work.
Mm-hmm.
And you make, well, tell me about your work. You make some artist books mm-hmm. and prints and...
And I trained as a printmaker. Mm-hmm. So I tend to work making multiples, mm-hmm. even when I make paper. So I make paper. I make most of the paper that I print on. Though this past year, I should mention, with the drought in California, I was trying to use up this pile of paper that I'd kind of hoarded.
Uh-huh.
you know?
Uh-huh.
I feel like we all have drawers. And so some of it was commercial because I was trying to be good about water.
Water, yeah.
But, and also just not hoarding. only a slight paper hoarding problem. I'm mm-hmm. stretching my arms way open right now.
Right.
Slight paper. But, but I've also always been sort of interested in street art and interventions. And, I have an ongoing project with an artist who's still in Philly called Book Bombs,
mm-hmm.
where we actually have we're part of a show right now at the Center for Book Arts in New York, where we were making paper from lots in Philadelphia and wheat pasting it around the city, sort of creating a narrative that we'd put up a print each month, and it would sort of, the story would sort of evolve if you knew where to look. And
oh.
and but we were also, we did some sort of public papermaking events, and I really felt like we did this one day, I should say, this is kind of an important day for me, was we did an intervention at this project called the Welcome House, which was up for 10 days in Love Park down in Philly, where they had this, it was curated by this woman named Marianne Bernstein, and it was this, basically this plexiglass cube, and the idea was like artists would inhabit it for a day and the public could kind of walk by, like it was kind of an artist zoo or something, but we decided to sort of do it a little differently, and we kind of came out of the Welcome House, and we were making paper, and then people were resist drying it on the walls inside the house, and so we had like some of the homeless people in the park making paper, and we had maybe one or two city council members, and just everybody kind of walking by, and having that, I mean, we got shut down at 7 o'clock at night because it was dark and the park was going to close, and we were turning away like 30 people who were just lining up to make paper.
Wow.
And but I felt like that was a really key moment in my thinking, just how paper can, you can have these community events, even just, you know, one day sort of flash events, and it's really amazing for people, and they don't have to be artists, because papermaking is sort of accessible, and you can still be very sophisticated, even if you don't have an art degree. And it kind of led me to this project right in front of us now, where this is the Rhinoceros Project, which I am collaborating with Ann Beck, who's quietly sitting over here.
Stitching.
So this is based on Albrecht Dürer's 1515 woodcut of this called the Rhinoceros. And Anne and I started this on a Facebook conversation where we both had some sort of very parallel ideas about the rhinoceros and Albrecht Dürer and inspiration. And we'd started talking about making a rhinoceros watermark, partially because the Western black rhinoceros has been declared extinct. It was declared extinct in 2011. And then actually DARD happened in 2014, and we were very involved in that. It was here in San Francisco, and I don't actually know the moment we decided to do this big community event thing, but it happened there, and we kind of came out of it, and we're like, we got to do this big thing where people are going to come together, and we started proposing it places without having actually really done it yet, and totally got rejected from everywhere we proposed it to, and so we just decided to kind of do it more guerrilla style.
Right.
We kind of kept trying to do it like as a residency at one place, do the whole thing. And I think that was a good thing that we got rejected, because we ended up with this model where we're sewing this, you know, this, it's 7 by 9 feet.
And it's a giant sheet image on it.
Yeah. And the fabric right now is actually a little bigger because we're going to stretch it on a frame.
Sure.
So we left a little extra. And we've been having sewing circles. We started at the San Francisco Center for the Book. They have an event in September called Roadworks. So we're right next to the steamrollers. Where it's a steamroller print event.
Yeah.
And then we were invited to be resident artists at a space in San Francisco called Ramon's Tailor, which is sort of this alternative storefront where artists are allowed to experiment, and you know, there's no commercial pressure, so you can really kind of do whatever you want within reason that doesn't, you know, blow the place up.
Right.
And we were there from November to January. We had a little break for the holiday, but and we are now going to be sometime soon, though we don't have a date yet, at the Kala Art Institute as part of their print public program. Again, having this sewing circle, and the idea being that we want to continue to have participants making this watermark with us. And when it is finally finished, probably in a year from now, we will then stretch it on a frame. I think we're probably going to use something like Hong Hong's, if you saw the last DARD, she did something along the similar to what she did.
So you'll stretch this sheet of cloth with the stitched imagery
facing up
and so it'll
pour a sheet
on top,
and
of
it will dry on
a watermark,
and then we will very carefully peel it off, and we want that to be sort of an event as well. And the goal is actually to make three, because there are three northern white rhinoceri left.
Oh, okay.
And they're on a preserve in Kenya.
Uh-huh.
And there is attempts. They're probably going to be lost within a few years. The male is... There's attempts to do IVF to kind of keep them going, because they're a subspecies, and they can crossbreed with other African species, but genetic diversity and versus isolated populations, kind of a science question there. That's our goal. And then the goal is then to sell those, and the money will go to rhinoceros preservation.
Cool.
I'm not good at breaking that into a short elevator speech yet.
No, that was fine. Well, tell me about one of your more recent artist books.
Okay.
That has handmade paper.
I guess.
Or your favorite one.
My favorite one. I don't know if I have a favorite one. Well, I guess the one, the most recent one that I did with handmade paper, we made a rhino zine with some, we'd been saving the cuts. Can I tell two?
Yeah.
The rhino zine, where we saved the trimmings from all this sewing, and we put them in some of the pulp that we had done some of the cast paper that rhinos in, and that's the cover for our zine, which tries to trace the whole history of not only Dora's print, but the rhinoceros it was inspired by, and just all these related, so how it ties into, like, the scope of history. But I guess another one that I made recently that uses cave paper, which I got to use. I was a resident artist last year, 2015, so I guess it's 2 years ago now, at the San Francisco Center for the Book for their Small Plates program, where you are invited to use their facilities and make a book that has to close to 4 by 4 inches. And I made this, it's a sort of a modified flag book where it has cave paper in it and Sekishu Japanese tissue paper in it as well. And it's sort of this wave that flows out. And it was kind of a different thing for me, but I have this fascination with history of color and pigment and dye. And it was based on this thing called the linguistic hierarchy of color. And the theory is that languages do not evolve names for colors until they can create them or reproduce them. So the first word, color word, that most languages are black and white, and then red, yellow, green, and last is always blue. And that blue, because blue is the hardest to create. It's not that people wouldn't see a blue sky, it's that because you didn't make it, you didn't need the mental category.
Right.
So like the Odyssey, which is about people sailing all over the ocean, does not have the word blue in it.
Right.
So... Oh, I was kind of fascinated by that.
Yeah. Okay, and what kind of teaching are you doing now?
I'm teaching printmaking at Stanford University, and I'm at San Jose State, so I'm part-time at both. And I'm doing the joint class at the School of Visual Philosophy in paper sculpture, where I'm working with a sculptor who knows more about mold making and armatures and that stuff than I do, and I'm talking about the paper, and we're also really trying to make it also about, like, thinking about ideas, not just, you know, getting the people who've registered for the class to think about, like, why paper and why sculpture and, you know, what does it mean and how do you expand your ability to talk about your own artistic practice? So.
Right. Cool. Anything else you're working on? We're a quiet pair.
I feel like I'm about to have postpartum because COVID just happened. I finished a book, a tunnel book. Well, I finished one copy of it. I have to edition it. That is actually my husband. So about a little over a year after we moved to California, my husband basically became disabled. And he's had some basically medical problems since then. So it was sort of, he has had a migraine for going on a little over 5 years now, every day, all the time.
Wow.
And he discovered, I guess I should open the door.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
The event is beginning.
We have an event beginning.
And we can wind down.
Yeah, and I'll mention this, but he discovered that when he rode his bike, that his migraine kind of dissipated for only when he was riding.
Right.
Like once he stopped riding, it came back, but... He couldn't do it on a stationary bike. It had to be actually riding on outside.
But when you stop at a stop sign. Yeah.
But somebody suggested that it might not be the exercise, it might be the balancing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was kind of a great metaphor for everything that we need. It's just balancing.
Right, and right.
So.
Okay, so we're going to start stitching, I guess. And
you going to sew?
Thanks so much, Michelle.
Thanks, Helen. Thanks so much.
Yeah, let me turn this off.
Sorry for finishing a podcast.